Welcome to the Sister Girls Book Club Podcast. I'm your host, Cherie, and we're back with another episode. It's been a minute, but this interview that I had is worth the wait. I'm telling you, you are going to want to sit down, hang tight, because I got a chance to interview Jemele Hill, y'all. Jemele Hill is multi-hyphenate. Her list of accomplishments transcends sports journalism, although that is where most of us were first introduced to her. Hill made regular appearances on ESPN programs, including ESPN First Take, Outside the Lines, and The Sports Reporters. She became an evening anchor of ESPN's flagship show, SportsCenter. She created a podcast called His and Hers. She's also a contributing writer at The Atlantic. And if that isn't enough, Hill is also a co-founder of a film and television production company called Lodge Freeway Media, and she currently hosts her own podcast called Jemele Hill is Unbothered. Her list of achievements are long, but very few knew Hill before the success and accolades. In her memoir, Uphill, we get a fuller picture of the woman we know today. Hill talks about growing up with two parents who were addicted to drugs, having an unstable childhood, all while trying her best to achieve her dreams. We read about her journey to ESPN and the infamous tweets read around the world calling the then sitting president of the United States of America a white supremacist. Her memoir is juicy, insightful, inspiring, and at times hard to read, but you can't stop reading because it's that good. In celebration of the paperback release of Hill's memoir, I got the chance to talk to her, and sister girls, this was a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Ms. Jemele Hill, how are you doing?
I'm good, and thanks for inviting me to do this and for the conversation. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, I'm so excited to have you here. I feel like we have a lot to cover in a little bit of time. So I just wanted to know, like, how on a scale of one to, I always ask people, on a scale of one to Beyonce Renaissance album, where are you at today? Beyonce Renaissance album being the best.
Oh, okay. what I would say is, I'm probably like a solid 7 today.
That's close, because Beyonce's Renaissance album is 10 and you had a 7.
I'm a solid 7. Yeah.
You're not doing bad. You're not doing too shabby.
I feel like I'm not doing too shabby. And, like always, it's always 1,000 things that are always filling my plate and that kind of thing. But I feel like as this year kind of winds down, there's just so much I'm looking forward to next year.
Very true, because I feel more hopeful and scared at the same time. So it's like an interesting feeling because of the climate of the world, but I do feel hopeful. So the reason why we're here to talk about the book, okay? The book that I tell everybody will have you shook. Uphill, your memoir, is in paperback now, so we're celebrating that. That's exciting. I always like, it's like almost you get a new, your book gets another breath. And so I'm going to just jump right in. So I tell everyone I know that the first 40 pages of this memoir is going to literally blow your mind. And I think, I don't know what I thought I was about to walk into, but I was expecting this. And this is coming from a girl who grew up in the hood, like in the hood of hoods. I'm from East New York, Brooklyn. So there was many moments I wondered while reading this book, if you ever thought you wouldn't make it, because we see the result of Ms. Hill now, but even looking back when you were writing, you're still yourself now out of it. So what kept you moving forward when there were so many moments when you could have changed your heart posture during your journey?
Well, I mean, I think it was just really important for me to be as transparent as I possibly could in writing in this memoir, because I knew there was a lot of parts of my life that people obviously had like no idea about, and not that they should be expected to know these things, but like there were, I know that people had a certain maybe image of me, a vision of me, because they had seen me on ESPN, they, you know, maybe have seen some of my commentary in other various spaces, and they didn't really know a whole lot about my life. And so as a result, I think this was my opportunity to kind of share some of my journey, my testimony, if you will, because many times it felt like that, so that they could understand, just my makeup, you know, the why I do come from the perspective that I come from, why I do have the point of view that I have. And so I wanted to share that not only so people can learn a little bit more about me, but also thinking of some of the factors that were prominent in my life, you know, having parents who both, are recovering addicts, growing up in Detroit, growing up in poverty, all of these different elements that I think are very relatable to people. So I wanted to not only share a bit and, share who I was, but also share with people. I wanted this to be something where people who had experienced some of the same things that I did, where they didn't feel any level of shame.
And I got that because I felt like even like just coming from like the hood point of view, like, and it's like we see you now, so we only see the refined version of you, like the well and the bright woman, the well traveled, the well, you are one of the, on the pillar. And so to know that you have the backstory, I think it definitely inspires people who are on the journey and just feel like, well, I can't get to that point because my life doesn't look like what they might assume your background looks like. And to talk about your background a little bit, in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, you said that you have to, when you become someone else, you have to lose something. So looking back, what do you think you lost and what do you think that you gained?
I think as women, especially as Black women, that's something that we struggle with, is that we, as we give more to other people, as we have our energy kind of absorbed, is that we're giving up bits and pieces of ourselves. And every woman can kind of relate to that. And so I definitely felt as if there were times in my journey where I was like losing bits and pieces of myself. It's kind of a hard thing to characterize because it happens by degrees. It's like death by a thousand paper cuts. And so I think some of the things, everything that I've gained has far exceeded anything that I felt like I lost. If anything, a lot of the things I lost, I felt like I needed to lose. And the things that I gained in terms of growth and understanding, patience and all those things, I think they were a part of the hardships that I endured. It's like going through those hardships allowed me to be in a space to have a level of growth that at times was like really uncomfortable. I mean, even this book writing process, it was a growth process. Writing this memoir, exposing myself, being vulnerable, because vulnerability is very difficult, I think, for a lot of women, especially a lot of Black women, because of not just our own expectations, but the expectations of other people around us. So I think for me, what I've tried to really concentrate on, particularly in this stage of my life and career, is not losing bits and parts of myself. I mean, because I think once we start to do that, we lose a sense of who we are, and we lose a sense of our own place. So, for me, I think the things that I lost were like mostly earlier in my life and career. I don't have that feeling nearly as much, now, because I think I'm in a much more grounded space.
No, well, I'm happy to hear that part because I when I read that, I was like, that's deep. I never thought about it in that perspective that you have to like remold or reshape yourself when you're going through different things, especially at an early age.
And it's even harder to do it then because you don't usually have the emotional maturity to even understand or process what's happening. And I think there were definitely, especially as it relates to my career, like the losing ourselves in our career is such an easy go-to, an easy default, because it is, even though we don't have really any control in our career, we feel like we do.
Very much more controlled environment. Like,
Yes,
if I just do
correct.
the work, I'll get to where I'm going. It's just
Exactly.
very straightforward.
We all do that math in our head. Like, if I just put in this much, this is going to be the outcome and the result of that. And so, I think that's something that we have to kind of be very cognizant of, is that we're not just displacing our emotions in another area and covering that up, because it's so much easier for us to grasp. And so my career at some points, has been a saving grace for me, but I don't think that's always good. I think that there are times where I probably need to sit in the emotion, sit in the discomfort, and not so readily hop to something that will give me a sense of, a sense of equilibrium, if you will.
Got you. And that makes sense because I think I'm at the portion where I'll get to where you're at. I'm still very much grounded in like if I just do the work, everything else will just like
Yeah.
fall into
And
place.
look, that's important. That's not to say that like not doing, you shouldn't, do the work and that you shouldn't have those expectations, but it is to say that your career life is far more unpredictable than we think it is. So it can't always be the refuge for us that we expect it to be.
Got it. So I purchased the book because of you. Like, you are a star. However, in the lowest of keys, your mom is she stuck out the like she was like so she was such a she was she's smart, she's witty, she's tough, she has a fortitude. But she was and she was also an addict, and she had you had you and her had a strained relationship because of that, and just a lot of events unraveled around that. You bore witness to it, right? And so I felt I have some, and it, when I read it, as much as I wanted, I think because I come from where I come from, I came into it with a level of it was not as big as a judgment, right? So I just was always like, she's gonna, I'm rooting for her. I wanted to get it. I always realized that she was a mom. It was certain like subtle moments. It was like she was always a mom. She was always just, she's never not just being a mom. And so we see our parents with like two sets of eyes as I'm learning and getting older. It's like the child eyes and then it's the adult eyes. And usually as we get older, the adult eyes, we human, it humanizes our parents. So what did that process look like for you to make that shift from having those kid eyes to those adult eyes? And did that alter your relationship once the book was actually released?
It is a it's a lifelong process for all of us. The thing about being somebody else's child is that you're used to being the center of attention, the center of their attention. And because of that, because you are, even as an adult, looking through them through the prism of a child, of like, no, they're supposed to have everything together. No, they're supposed to know better. Or they're, you want your you the level of perfection you sometimes expect from your parents is frankly unrealistic. And it's just like, that's not the case. But it's sort of they're in a catch 22 job, because it is their job to always relay to you that they have everything under control. But as an adult yourself, that is not possible. Okay. And especially when I think about my mother's own journey, I mean, she had me at 18 years old, and I think about what I was like at 18 years old, and there is no way I could have fully raised another human being at 18 years old, being unwed, living in Detroit, being working class, and like I could not have done what she did. And so I don't think that really sunk in until much later in my life. And I think once we get past seeing our parents as superheroes, and when the roles start to change, when you're an adult and you actually become more of the parent, then you see more of the flaws and more of the humanity of them, because they maybe reach a point where that superhero image they've always tried to that they've always tried to portray is not possible anymore. And then you start to understand them more as human beings and understand the grace that they need and deserve, as opposed to when you are much more unforgiving, because when you're still depending on them for things. So for me, it was very much a lifelong process. The great thing about the book is that it allowed us to have a lot of conversations that, for as many as we had, particularly about her addiction, as much as I had witnessed, there was still so much more to her story that I had not even begun to scratch the surface on. And I think learning those parts, a lot of which were difficult to hear, allowed me to have even more grace for her than I already had. And while sir, my mother, the thing about her life story, even in the real deep throes of her addiction, my mother never stopped being a mother. She never stopped being a parent. And she also never made her lifestyle seem cool. And I think that part is important, is that sometimes the trauma, the generational trauma that's passed down, is because of there's a lot of sanitizing about what's going on. My situation was never sanitized, so I never walked away with some unrealistic idea of what was happening in our house. And that left a big impression on me in a positive way, in the sense that I knew I never wanted to follow the same path. That was not attractive to me at all. And sometimes the best parenting your parents can do is to show you what not to do. And my mother definitely was able to do that. And so because of that automatically put me in a much different position to not have to repeat some of the same mistakes that she felt like that she made. I mean, just by the fact that she had me 18, we were having conversations very early in my house about birth control, very early in my house about sexual responsibility and about not bringing no babies home and all of those things. We had those conversations real early. And also, unfortunately, because of the sexual abuse that my mother endured for a good bit of her life, we were having those conversations very, very early as well, because my mother, in her mind, the number one thing she could give me was something she didn't get, which was protection. And you cannot protect your kids from everything. It's just not possible to do that, and it's a big task as it is. But she wanted, at the very least, for me to understand that she always had my back, no matter what. She was always going to support me. And I think that was such a strong foundation for me as I grew older. But once I kind of turned a corner in my own adulthood, I think seeing her humanity more, it really tripled my respect for her. So if there was one takeaway I wanted people to have from this book, is that be it your mother, your grandmother, your father, all those who are closest in your life, it's important that you find out who they were, absent of your role in their life. Because before your parents and your mother and before they ever even had you, they had dreams, they had disappointments, they had a whole life that had nothing to do with you. And you need to find out what that life was, because I think it helps you understand them better. It helps you understand the dynamic of your relationship, better. I mean, my mother wanted to be a doctor. Like, I know growing up, my mother always watched medical shows. She was always very much into science. She went to school to be a medical laboratory technician, understanding that it all came from her as a child wanting to be a doctor, because when she had a childhood accident that where she almost died, it was first responders and the quick thinking of my uncle that saved her life. And she loved the idea of helping people. And that is what made her want to be a doctor. And those are the kinds of things that you need to find out about your people. Like, oh, you wanted to do
Ask
that?
them questions and that because they have
Yeah.
questions.
Ask them what their lives were like. And then to understand from her, why that never happened and how that set her on a certain path and a certain course, it gives you much more understanding into who they are.
And I think you captured that well because the whole time when I was reading, especially because a lot of the first portion of the book is about your life with your mom. So it's like she takes up so much space. And you could have started that book from anywhere, from college, and then kept going to kind of start like your journey and your career. But you did take the route of kind of like showing us your life, and it included your mom. And so your mom is a survivor of sexual assault and abuse. And then you had an account. So I won't give it away because it's in the book. But I believe that when someone violates a person in that way, they kind of kill a person. Like they kill the person. So like you, if this happened on a Tuesday afternoon, the person you was Tuesday morning, it goes. Like it's you're not that you're altered, right? So that's one of the reasons why I kept when I thought about your mom, I was like, dang, she can't be there in that way because she's not even the same person. Like this is a whole different person that's trying to be, and then it happened more than one time. And then so looking back, how did that incident, your own incident, and then realizing that your mother went through something as well, affect your outlook on the world when it comes to intimate relationships and friendships? And did you gain a better understanding of your mother and like her plight? Like it was like, oh, that's why. Like you couldn't be there for me like that because you weren't even who you started out to be. Like everything was transformed.
Yeah, I love that observation that you made, because even now, with my mother having recovered from so much, there's still a brokenness that I don't think will ever heal. Because, as you just mentioned, the degree of sexual trauma my mother suffered, from being a rape survivor to also being molested as a young child. And the abuse was consistent and nonstop. And it broke something inside of her, which made it very easy for her to turn to drugs because of when you have that amount of trauma that is just built up, it is cartilage, it is an open wound that just never really heals. It also made me understand my mother's fierce protectiveness that smothered me quite a bit, and sometimes was hard for me to breathe in because it was that high, it was so intense. And I think once as she throughout my youth explained some of the things she had been through, she didn't go into great detail. She told me it happened. And a big reason she told me it happened is because she wanted me to be aware of the signs so that if I were ever in any of those situations or if something ever happened to me, that she knew, she wanted me to know what to do, and she wanted me to know that she would be there for me. And so, yeah, it drastically changed her. And because her abuse started so early, I would have had to know my mother when she was 3 years old to know a different person than what I saw before all the trauma began. And so that part is just heartbreaking for me. And so later on, as a teenager, when I had my own experience, I think the only reason, my mother's trauma, I write this in the book, is like her trauma saved me. Like, they literally saved me. I didn't go through nearly the tenth of what she experienced, and I was able to escape my attacker. My mother was not. And so, but the only reason I was is because she told me what to do. And in those situations, and if that wasn't the case, then I'd be telling a much different story right now. I might be in a much different place right now if it wasn't for that. And so for that, I'm eternally grateful. But I think mostly it helped me understand why she was very distrustful of men. It helped me understand why that was her consistent message to me, is that they are not to be trusted, and that the awareness that it built in me. But in a way, it was also very debilitating, because I think for a time it was a real roadblock to me developing maybe close relationships with people that I was that I was intimate with. I think it was a roadblock because I wasn't really sure if it was okay to trust them, and despite them maybe showing me evidence that it was okay. So it did definitely had an impact and left an imprint on how, I dealt with certain relationships. And, even with her being, married multiple times, and women in my family, period, being married multiple times, I was of the opinion that marriage was definitely not for me. Because having seen what they went through, I was like, I don't know if this is something if I should do, or if even something that I want to do. Because that was the other thing too. We were talking a moment ago about losing parts of yourself. I saw them lose themselves in those marriages, and I was like, if that's what comes with it, I don't know if that's for me. Yeah, exactly.
But the thing about the women in your family, they were strong and they were united, and your grandmother was another like person who stood out. And she was the one, because she reminded me of my grandmother on the passed away in 2018, but it was like that strictness, that black and white, but it's that love, the love of giving you resources. And she was the one who gave you the typewriter, right? That's when it's like your world opened up. And because I write and create stories, I know what that means. So it's like during your time of like growing up, when you first were introduced to writing, because you're a writer now, you in Atlanta, you know all the things already. So it's like, I'm here, girl. But when you first, if you can remember, like when it first started, like what did writing mean to you during those times in your life, those pivotal moments when all you had was.
Man, writing meant a lot. Like, it was, and the thing is that it came so naturally. I didn't even realize or appreciate its meaning until afterward. But in that moment, like, it was such a safe space for me, be it in my journal, be it in the stories, the poems and short stories that I wrote. It was an outlet. It was a great outlet for me. And because it was an outlet that was not dependent on another person, I think that was also key in terms of me developing a sense of like independence. I could get that through writing because writing is whatever world you want it to be. At least creative writing mostly is what I'm speaking to. So, it just was a relief. It was a salve. It was self-soothing. It was therapeutic. It was something that didn't require me to, have to like emotionally wager anything. And so writing meant everything to me. I mean, it was a combination, I would say, of writing and reading because, it was the reading that made me love writing. And it was the writing that made me love reading, right? Is that, you read a great story and suddenly my mind is going 1,000 miles an hour because I'm wondering, like, how did they construct this? How did they think of this character? How did they know that this should be the character's motivations? Like, it just made me fall in love and want to learn more and be more curious about what the process of writing really was. And so, that part, it just invigorated me in like a completely different way. And even though I didn't know any writers, I certainly didn't know any journalists or any authors, it felt like something that I was destined to do.
And so you went through the route of journalism, and that's a job that can grant you, like, it literally changed your life. You traveled, you saw, you met, interviewed, you were able to tell stories and amplify voices. And in doing so, I always feel like when you interview somebody, you always pick up a thing, or you pick up a just something that they leave you with, even though you're trying to interview them on a larger scale, but you're like, dang, that was a good one, or that was a life lesson, or that helped. So do you have like any two or three quotes or advice that was given to you that have been long lasting while you were on the job and it has carried you in your life?
Somebody told me a long time ago, like the best revenge is success. And that always definitely stuck with me. And control what you can control. And and both those are they're cousins, very much so. A lot of times, especially as we are trying to thrive professionally, we can, if we're not careful, begin to get a little consumed with what everyone else's path is. So you're like, why did Rhonda get that promotion and not me? Or why is she getting this? Or why is this happening for them? We tend to like start doing that because we feel like we're putting in the work. We feel like we're doing what we're supposed to do and we're not yielding the same results as other people. And the whole control what you can control mantra was very helpful because it forced me to just really have very tunnel vision about what I'm doing and where I'm supposed to be. I learned to through these two sort of idioms, I learned to appreciate a closed door as much as I appreciated an open one. Because we all, I mean, I do, I appreciate a good closed door. I appreciate a canceled meeting. I appreciate a closed door. All of those things because I think we assume that every opportunity we want is one that actually is an opportunity that truly will serve us. We assume we're going to be good at that. We also make the assumption of thinking that, an opportunity we may see for ourselves in our head is something that's right for us. And I have so many examples throughout my life where there were things that were turned down or that didn't come my way that I looked up and I was like, wow, I'm really glad that didn't happen. One of the biggest examples I write about it, in the book was, I was obsessed with working at Sports Illustrated. That was my dream job. And they offered me a job when I was 22. It didn't feel right. I didn't take it. And I thought, oh yeah, for sure. I'll work there eventually. I've never worked there. And to be honest, that wasn't where I was supposed to be, even though in my mind up until that point, I had been building it up. Like I'm supposed to be a Sports Illustrated. I'm supposed to be, writing these types of stories. It's not where I wound up at all. And the same thing with ESPN. ESPN was never on my vision board, ever. Like I didn't think about ESPN. Of course, I enjoyed watching ESPN like a lot of people, but it was not the place I ever saw for myself. And it turned out to be the best job I ever had. And so I think sometimes, and I tell these young people this all the time, because they get so caught up in living in a specific city, working for a specific place. It's like that might not even be the place for you. You have no idea, you know? So always keep an open mind about what could be a good place, or more importantly, think about your professional and personal development first. And then you'll figure out the rest kind of after that. And so yeah, for me, I think part of my growth process in maturity is understanding that what's meant for me is for me, and there's nothing anybody can take away from that. And if I just control how hard I work, if I control my own preparedness, the things that are truly within my purview, like I can't control what other people think about me. I can't control whether or not somebody thinks I'm qualified for a certain position or for an opportunity, but I can control what I put into it. I can control even something basic like showing up on time. I can control all of those things. So those are the things I choose to focus on, as opposed to focusing and being obsessed with the things I don't have any control over.
That's good stuff, because it's very, you get boggled down and you like obsessed over why you're not where you're supposed to be. And it's so hard because
Correct.
you want to get there. But speaking of ESPN, I always say that nobody wants to be the main character on Twitter. And but when I like that's the thing, you do not want to wake up and be the main character on Twitter. But when I think back to the Trump incident, your tweets basically calling him out and calling him a white supremacist. But now, after reading your story, both professionally and privately, it seems like a minor hiccup. When I look at the grand scheme of your whole life, it seems like it was just like, technically, this is not her first time on the rodeo. Like, she's been here before, where she's put her opinions out and put her thoughts out to the public on many different occasions throughout your career, and you received blowback. Now, do you think that you were prepared for this type of blowback? Because it was on a much grander scale. Like, you literally had beef with the president of the United States of America. That's wild. But did you think you were prepared for it? Or was it all too much too quickly? And how did you keep a sane mind through that? Because that was a
Well, I think what prepared me is like sort of everything you read before you get to that point in the book. Like a lot of the things that I experienced in childhood, witnessing that, like when you experience like real hardship, you know what real hardship is. Something like the president going off on you on Twitter does not really seem that bad. You know what I'm saying? It's bad in the sense. The worst part of it really was dealing with the level of bigotry he often generates. That was the worst part, because you're dealing with, frankly, a lot of unhinged people who, they're threatening me and, threatening my physical safety. And then I gotta worry about like, where am I going? If they, all those kinds of things. Like, that's probably the worst part of that. But just being in that kind of under that kind of scrutiny, being discussed internationally, becoming the walking think piece is not fun. No, it is not fun. Yeah, but at the same time, because I've had at that point in my career, I'd had a public job for a long time. You do understand that there are certain conditions that come along with the job, even though, to use your words, you hope to never be the main character on Twitter. You do understand that you're living a public something that's in the public eye, and because of that, the level of scrutiny you receive, and especially living under the public eye as a Black woman, there's going to be a different level of scrutiny. And I have been dealing with racist attacks since I was in college, and while it's a much different dealing with them when you're working for a student newspaper versus when you're at ESPN, there's like a different level of scope. I sort of knew what I was getting into and what to expect. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty surreal. Like, I never in a million years did I expect my name to come up at a White House press briefing. Never did I expect for the president of the United States to say I was single-handedly dragging down the ratings of a network, or that I was just to be targeted in that way as a private citizen, public job, but I'm still a private citizen, right? I did not expect any of that to happen. And even when I sent that tweet, I never expected those tweets to rise to rise to the level of the White House, to where the president of the United States cares what a sports center anchor is saying about them on social media.
Yes, but in that, I feel like in that turmoil or in that time, it was like, because I was there, like, how people like, were you there? I was there, not where you, I was there on the internet. And I honestly want to talk about Black love, but not in the intimate way, the Black love where, like, I work at the Schomburg, that's number one. I work at the Schomburg for Black, you know, so you know it's very Black. So we had conversations. Mm-hmm. Then I had conversations with my friends in the group chat. And, you know, when it all came down, it was like, no, I understand what you're saying. But what we're saying, Sarah Sanders, is like, if she gets fired, we ride at dawn. Like, it's not, it was like, we were the fist that Iyanla banged on the table. It was like, not on our watch. Like, it was such a thing. And I feel like Black people rallied around you in a way it was like, protect her at all costs. Like, in my world, it was like, you didn't say anything that was like, we didn't know, like, had we not said this prior? It was just like, it was new news. So my question is, did you know how much Black people loved, admired, and respected you prior to the Trump situation? And how did it make you feel once you saw like that outpouring of love?
You know, it's funny because I guess because I've never, I definitely, regardless of what my title said or the level of exposure I had publicly, I was never one of those Black people that was going to ever distance myself from my people or not be connected to my community. I always was. So I always felt like Black people loved me. But the difference is like, because, you know, we have levels to our Black love. And the difference was when that went down, it was, I knew Black people loved me. Then when that happened, I knew Black people fucked with me, which is different, right? And so that's different, right? That's a different kind of love. Like you said, that's that we ride at dawn love, right? Like, you know, kind of how like right now, Keke Palmer's in the news and all of us are like, we ride at dawn.
At dawn.
You want to do?
At
dawn. Certain people, we like, what you want to do, all right? So to feel that, and more importantly, you know, I always felt it from the community. The part that really surprised me was the number of Black athletes that jumped into the fray, because even though I have very good relationships with a lot of them, they have a lot to lose. You know, anytime they decide to jump up, publicly advocate, especially we talking about them getting in the middle of a beef between me and the president of the United States. So like, that's a different level of skin in the game. And so because when I saw, you know, Colin Kaepernick tweeting on my behalf, Kevin Durant, LeBron, like all these people that I did not have a relationship with them at all, like other than me talking about them on TV, like me and LeBron, I have his number, like I did not know this man, right? And Kevin Durant, same thing. Colin, him and I have met in passing, did not know this man. And so for them to put themselves on the line to speak up for me, it was just humbling. I was honored. And not that I ever would had that not happened, but it just firmly planted in me and further convicted me of the fact that, like, no matter what, I'm riding for us, like, no matter what. Yeah. And I've said this many times, and it's true, it's like, that support saved my job, because when ESPN saw that this was not a one-sided argument or one-side, like there wasn't, like granted, you know, the Make America Great Again folks, they just loud, they just real loud. But there was a whole nother contingent of people who agreed with me, supported me, and felt like what I said was right. And them understanding that this are two Americas, it's two different types of things happening here, I think it's ultimately what saved me from being, you know, fired, because, you know, the athletes were somebody that ESPN, they wanted to be in business with. Certainly, they know how much Black people love ESPN overall. So they weren't trying to, you know, they weren't trying to piss off a core piece of their constituency. So because of that, I think that is what gave me, frankly, some leverage. So for that, I will always be indebted to Black people, or I should say more indebted to Black people, because it wasn't like You know, I didn't feel that my community stood behind me. It wasn't that like when there was no controversy and I was just a black woman on TV and they appreciated the representation of our community that I showed. I felt the love then, but I felt it even stronger. And that's when you find out how much people really mess with you. It's like when it goes down. Like it's easy to love somebody when everything's going great. It's when it goes down that you realize like, oh, okay, I'm in there.
And I think to your point was that I felt like when we were like really tweeting like, oh, it's not going down like this, not today, it was like because we knew that you were someone that would protect us too. Like had it been another situation, even so many times in your job, when you like that was another thing. I was like, dang, you constantly put yourself on the sword to like you would be going through the worst, not the worst time, but just like this is not the best moment right now. Like if I had another opportunity, I would have dipped. But you knew that there were other black producers, other black people on this team that would have that position. So it wasn't even so much about like, dang, just take me out of it because now I can do my own thing. It was like, let me see if we can make this work, or how can we put other people in position that are black because we need that representation overall, not just my face and not just seeing me. So I feel like that spoke to even when it went down with the Trump, the people within your organization, they rose to that occasion too. And everybody would have been scared because it was just it's one of those things that's scary when it's like your bread and butter is like, dang, I don't know. I could be, you know, I could kind of toe that line, but they like rose and it was like, nah, we with you too. And so I thought that was just dope to see and just to see it from the other side of like the professional scope. Because we of course the people on Twitter and stuff, it's like we're not walking that walk like you and your team were, but we felt emboldened to be like, nah, but the people there, they had other, you know, other things to lose and relationships, and they still was just like, nah, we gonna ride with her too. So I think that is just something I feel like that's dope.
Well, and it's something that I think all of us have to, remember, which is why I said like my connection to community was something that was always something that I considered to be sacred, always something that I wanted to honor, because the reality is like this job and whatever successes I have, like at some point that stuff goes away, or at some point it just doesn't matter as much. What's going to always matter is your community and my people. They're going to always matter. And so that's why it's very disappointing sometimes when we see certain black people in prominent positions who turn their back on the community, because at some point that validation you're seeking elsewhere ain't going to pan out and you're going to have to come back home. And what that looks like when you have to make that humbling walk back is going to be directly reflective of how you treated your community when there was nothing in it for you. And so that's why, that's not to say that black people always agree with me, because they don't they always agree with me. But it is to say, I hope they know that I have a deep, abiding, and unconditional love for us, and I'm gonna fight for us. And the because that's just it's just in my spirit to do that. That is just part of my natural DNA is to do that. And so I'm never going to allow myself to be disconnected from, my own people. And so I think that's why people once we do rise to these certain levels and get in these different kind of rooms, we have to maintain that sense of connection. It's even more important that we do it then, because it's so many things that will allow us to lose it that we have to really protect it and keep it sacred.
I just got some fun questions to ask you before we wrap up. So on TikTok, there's a clip of Beyonce saying, and we've used the like the her voice in a lot of things that I want to do something big. I want to do something that says I'm here. And she goes, Beyonce. And you, in my mind, this was your thought when you and your fiance did the visuals for Ape Shit for your engagement. And I'm just like, in my mind, I know it's a while back, but what made you want to recreate that? And did you know that it was going to be like a cultural, like it was going to be a moment for the culture?
Well, let me. I'm gonna be totally honest. It was not my idea. It was my husband's idea. Oh yeah, no. He between the two of us, like my husband is. Even though I guess I'm in a creative field, like he, like when it comes to marketing, creativity with those kinds of things, he is a genius. He is great with that. So I, if you would have just been me, we just would have done some regular engagement photos, you know, just normal stuff you see people do. He was like, no, we got to take it to a higher level. And I was like, okay, what do you want to do? And I don't know how, like Beyonce and Jay-Z, you know, obviously two artists we both respect and that, you know, we've been listening to our whole lives. And yeah, we just came up with the idea of recreating Ape Shit. And we shot everything in Detroit. It was a long day to shoot it, but it came out so spectacular that when it came to our wedding, we were trying to think of stuff like, okay, we dropped this engagement video, you know, it was kind of fire. What we gonna do for this? And we were just brainstorming and came up with the idea of doing the belly intro for our wedding video intro. And yeah, so like he's very good at doing stuff like that. I'm definitely of the mind, you know, and this is where I think we coalesce, is that okay, you give me a theme, an idea, and I'm like, we gotta commit at all costs. So when it came to the Ape Shit video, I was like, no, we have to do it literally scene by scene. We have to line this up scene by scene. Okay, this has to be perfect. This has to be perfect. And then put our own spiel on it. And big shout out to the Detroit Public Library because they just let us have the run of the place and didn't charge us anything or whatever.
He broke the internet because people was like, yo, did you see the video? It was fire. Like, yo, this is wild. Like, when did they do this? When did they rent the whole place out? Like, it was so
We
dope.
did not. They hooked us up.
Shout out to him.
They
I really was like, I feel it was y'all. Just because I don't know
no.
what to say, I think, girls, like, you know.
Nah, but you know what? Here's the other thing too, is that you know, people wouldn't guess this because I'm again in a public career, but I'm actually a more of an introvert. Like I don't really like being the center of attention. My husband ain't got no problem with it, so it's another way where we sort of balance out. And so he's able to sort of bring out that performer in me because it's not really naturally something that I do. Like he's more of a performer who knows how to like, really command a crowd and that kind of stuff. For me, again, despite the fact that I know people see me on TV and I may look totally comfortable, these are situations I have to sort of geek myself up to do. All right, he can just do it just like that. So, you know, having him there to do this with, it was good for, you know, good for me in terms of like it was able to bring out the performer, you know, in me.
That's dope. All right. So on now, I have to be very clear when I say this, ask you this question because it could get broken up and misconstrued. So I'm gonna say it slow. So in the movie Love Jones, I don't know if you watched the movie Love Jones, but I love that movie.
I've seen it like 7,000
All right.
times,
So
yes.
it's the part when the guy is trying to explain something, they like, all right, break it down so it will forever be.
Have be broke.
All right. Our good sis Ebony K. Williams, I love her. She told us that she's going for the CEO. Our auntie Iyanla Van Zandt told us that maybe we should expand and not only go for the CEO. And more recently, Uncle Tyler Perry told Black women specifically that if a man loves us and treats us right, and if all he can afford to pay is the light bill, then that's fine. Now, your mother has a proverb. I'm not going to say what it is, but
Yeah, you already know what
I
it
agree with her 100%. So you probably already know my stance on this situation. Okay. Now, you are considered a high-value woman, period. By definition, you are a high-value woman. So this is why the question is going to go to you, because you technically are in that space. So before you met your husband, before you met your husband and you got with him, you were in a relationship for almost a decade, right? And in the book, you specifically said, I'm sure other things were at play, that you knew you couldn't marry him because you would take on the brunt of the finances, period, within the relationship. So we have Black women who are career focused, who are entering their careers, who are like upward mobility, who already arrived, who's in there, like, according to the world, once you leave your 20s, you're just done if you're a woman and you're not married already. So if they have standards and specific requirements and they want to find love, because if people didn't know the rest of your story and they would have just heard, oh, she's in her 30s. She left this guy. He's probably a good man. That's a good man, Savannah. She don't have children. She never gonna get her like husband. It's a wrap for her because that's the running story in the podcasting world when it comes to Black women. But that wasn't the end of your story. You met your husband like very organically, and you got married, according to the world, your age would have never happened. And you are
Yeah.
a value woman. So what is, like, break it down to us. Should
Yeah,
we have the standards, abandon the standards, bring the standards down? Where are we with it? Give us your advice, best practice.
so I think for me, what was people get so focused on dollar amount, like it should be dollar for dollar and this kind of thing. I think building does have to be a part of the process when you're with somebody. The reason my previous relationship, before I met my husband, didn't work out is because it wasn't just about him not being able to financially meet me at the level that I was. It was the lack of ambition to do so. That's what it was. And I'm out here busting my tail, doing everything that I can to try to create a life for us, and it wasn't reciprocated. And it can't, so like even if I had to help him build that, that would have been a problem. Like if he'd have said, hey, I want to go back to school and pursue this, I'd be like, I got you. Like as long as you have a plan that seems reasonable, you're going to follow something and be passionate about something that you love, I got you. No problem with that whatsoever. But if I sense you sabotaging the process, then we're going to have a problem. And so there were moments, big moments, unfortunately, in our relationship where he sabotaged that process. And I felt like he was never going to get out of that behavior. And because of that, that's why I left. And not only that, it eats at your relationship because then I start to lose respect for you because I see that you're sabotaging the process, sabotaging our success as a couple. And you're also putting me in a bad spot because now it's sort of like I can't even be comfortable in this dynamic because everything is on me. Like if I stop working, we done. And it's like it can't be that. You know what I mean? That's very sort of one-sided. And I what I would say, and I heard both those conversations, Ebony K. Williams and Ayanla. I have dated, and he was a blue collar man, by the way. And so, and but I before, I mean, I've dated both blue collar men. I've dated professional men. I've dated professional men who are terrible. So like, it's not even about like what they do. It's about their maturity and how they approach life. And so what I would say for Black women is that I don't think we have to be super specific because some of us are a little too specific with what those requirements are. But I do think that this idea and this constant trope that there's something wrong with us having standards is a bad one. I don't think it's asking too much for, especially at our big age, that is asking for the other person in the relationship to be financially stable. I don't think that's asking a lot. And now what stability looks like to you is going to differ for everybody. Some women are like, I'm only dating a man that's making six figures. Yeah, but like you can be financially secure and not make six figures. Like you're paying all your bills, you can go on vacations, you can do very other things. Maybe you invested well. Like that security looks different depending on what it is. So something my only sort of small criticism of us is like, I don't think we need to be so specific all of the time. You have to leave room for some possibilities. And you also have to be leave room for growth. I mean, you may meet a man making $80,000, but he desires to maybe one day have his own trucking company. If you are also bringing, obviously you have a career, you bring that to the table. There's nothing wrong with you helping him build that. That's part of what you're doing together as a couple. And besides, like, once you get to a certain point in your relationship, all that going in one pot anyway. So it don't even matter. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't even matter. And so what I would say is that we do have to concentrate more, and we should make sure that we're giving value and concentrating on men that deliver peace to us. And that's not always through finances. Because I know some women. And listen, I laid to bear some of the relationships my mother had in my book. And there are definitely some examples of I've seen her with men who have means and they treated her terribly. Being with somebody financially stable is not a guarantee that person is going to treat you right. Because I know plenty of very miserable rich women who are in marriages that are not great just because they have men who think just because I make a lot of money, I get to tell you what to do and I get to do what I want. And I know I didn't want any part of that. I wanted somebody who understood how to emotionally take care of me. And so that mattered a lot to me. But I am a little tired of this idea that it's our standards that are holding us back. And it's our standards that are the reason that we aren't that we're still single, or that once you're past a certain age that you're just to be thrown to pasture. I mean, I got married at 43. My best friend, she just got married, and she's in her mid-40s as well. She got married a couple months ago, right, to a black man who had no kids and who had never been married, just as I had. All right, and so yes, I mean, yes, it's like it's. So I think we will get into trouble when we start operating from a scarcity mindset, right? It's like when you operate from a scarcity mindset of like, I have to make this work because there's no other men out here because everybody keeps telling me this. Or when we start operating that way, I think that's when we start making bad decisions. I never have once worried about meeting a man, not one time. I'm not worried about meeting them. I'm not worried, I mean, marriage was something to me that was never like central to my existence anyway. But I knew that if I did choose and want to do that, I'd probably do it later in life because I wanted to do it at a point where I felt like I was willing to sacrifice, my career and certain things, to make maybe the relationship work that I might, need to do that, like be it like location or other stuff. But I never operated from the scarcity mindset. And I find that when my friends have operated from that, you a lot of times they wind up making bad choices because they're listening too much of people telling them about what their value is and that they need to drop their standards and all this. And you better latch on to this one because they may not be that many that come around. Honestly, there's room for both Ebony K. Williams and Ayanna to be right. I maybe am not as specific as Ebony necessarily, but I think we would be lying to ourselves if we said financial stability wasn't important. I think it's important for men and women. Now, granted, men have the benefit of because they have been positioned as providers, that for them, they may not see like having a woman who is not financially stable is not a big risk for them. All right. It is a huge risk for women because of what we stand to lose. Right. And so that's why that's going to feel like it's a little bit imbalanced. Unfortunately, I have seen, women that I know, women in my family who have been wiped out financially because that imbalance was there. And even in the relationship I had, with my ex, where we were financially on different pages, the way it ate at our relationship is that, he lost his sense of pride, frankly. It's like because he had a woman for a time who was carrying everything. And that was an uncomfortable position for him to be in. The problem was he got a little too comfortable in that position. And that's when, things kind of took a turn. But it's uncomfortable to be in that spot. And so like I would like to think that as much as I know I hear men joke about like having a sugar mama or, one day getting in a situation where they getting paid alimony or whatever it is, it's like at the end of the day, nobody wants to be relying on anybody else. You just don't. And so I think black women are okay. But it's just our whole lives, we just continue to hear how undesirable we are for various reasons. And it's like I'm sort of tired of that trope. You find it when you find it. And I promise you, ladies, there is no expiration date on when you will find it. Whatever is your standards, if you have the self-awareness to understand that, like, these are my deal breakers and I'm sticking to them, stick by those deal breakers. But the only thing I would say is just make sure whatever are your deal breakers or whatever are your standards, they're not so strict that you won't allow some flexibility because somebody really might surprise you out
Yeah, that's a great answer. That's a great answer. I
there.
feel like you wrong with this answer. This is my last question, just to wrap things up. Throughout the whole memoir, I felt like one of the biggest things that I learned about you and that I kind of was like that nugget that you take away was that you've trusted yourself time and time again. That was kind of something that rang true. You trusted yourself over and over. But there was a moment when I was like, dang, what if this was me? What would I do? The idea, the fact when you came to leaving ESPN. because and doing things your own way, because when you are in a good position, even though your dream wasn't to be at ESPN, you got there. And because you know that's the dream, again, another movie, The Devil Wears Prada, and they tell like you have the job that every girl wants. Like you got the job, you're there. So it's like when you made that had the moment to say, you know, I'm ready to like leave this. I've come to the end. But technically you had more time in your contract. You still had time there, or you still could have been there longer. And when you tell other people, like, okay, and they get scared, how do you make sure that you make sure that you're not living in someone else's dream and that you're living in your own? And I think for us, I think you can speak to it because millennials, Gen Z, we're all trying to figure out what are our dreams and what are the dreams for other people have for us, and how to listen and trust ourselves. Like, so how do you do that when something is no longer serving you, when you have it all, quote unquote?
Well, this is the one thing that you have to realize. You have to take stock in the sense of like, if you think about maybe all the employers you have or all the career situations you've been in, you've never not worked hard. If anything, you've always exceeded expectations. That's generally how most of us have been, especially as Black women. I mean, that's overachieving is what we do, right? So why would you think if you went out on your own or if you took a chance on yourself, you wouldn't do the same thing? You're going to be even that much more determined. So what I would say is, if you just have the mindset that I'm gonna work just as hard for myself as I did for everybody else I already have, you should be okay. And that should be enough for you to trust yourself. You ain't gonna let yourself go hungry. So why wouldn't you trust yourself? You're like, you're not gonna do that. Like, you're not gonna let yourself down. And I think most of the time, the self-doubt that we have when it comes to betting on ourselves, when it comes to stepping out on our own, we are carrying the self-doubts of others and not of ourselves. And all we have to do is look at our own track record and how we've been in every situation. And that should be enough to convince you that you have earned the trust in yourself. Okay. And so when I left ESPN, even though a lot of people thought I was crazy, because not only am I leaving a legacy media company, I'm leaving one of the best jobs in sports media by leaving SportsCenter. That is what everybody else's dream might have been, who was kind of, that don't mean that was my dream, right? Like I loved ESPN, I loved working there, and it was great, but SportsCenter was a job I didn't like. So like, I'm gonna keep this job I don't like just because all y'all think it's a dream job? No. I think there's more for me out here, and I trusted myself enough to find out what that was. And even though it can be scary, even though you will think of a lot of worst case scenarios, like, what if I do this and I don't find another job and no one else hires me? Or we were going to go through the doomsday scenarios. I understand that. But all you have to do is just think about what your track record. I've never not had a job. So why would I suddenly not have a job? Like, I was going to be able to find a job. So it was just a matter of detaching myself from this perception of what everybody else's thoughts and opinions and characterizations of what my dream job was. So what I would say to people is that if you just maintain that same work ethic that you've had in making money for everybody else, maintain that for yourself, and I think you'll be fine.
Oh, that's dope. Flash questions before we leave. It's really quick. You know, flash questions, you gotta have answer them right then and there. All right, favorite book that you read in 2023?
Night Crawling by Layla Motley.
Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Writing in the day or writing at night?
Writing at night.
Is it Uchi Wally or is it One Mic?
Oh, one mic.
Girlfriends or Insecure?
Oh, gosh.
Gotta hurry up. Listen.
All right. I'm gonna say girlfriends.
Wu-Tang or the Fugees?
Wu-Tang.
Martin Luther King or Malcolm X?
Martin Luther King.
And who is Jemele Hill?
A servant.
Like that. I haven't had that answer yet. Thank you so much, Jamil Hill. I really appreciate you for taking the time out. This was dope. I hope you had a good time. I learned so much by reading your memoir. I've always been inspired. You were like up there, and I felt like this is going to give people, especially Black women, a chance to just see you as a person and understand that we have a lot more in common than we don't. And like just to you humanize yourself in a way that I don't think a commercial or sit down or a movie or anything else would have done. So I appreciate you. And thank you so much. Do you have anything else?
Yeah. No, I don't. I just want to thank you for the conversation and allowing me to not just share more about my memoir and my journey, but just more of myself. So I appreciate you. So thank you.